Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Detroit and earned a BS degree in International Political Economy from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, and a Juris Doctor of Law from the University of Michigan Law School. From 2002 to 2006, he worked for Johnson Controls. And in 2007, he joined Bridgewater Interiors. And since 2015, he's been its president and CEO. Bridgewater Interiors is an automotive interiors manufacturing firm specializing in just-in-time assembly, sequencing, and delivery of seating systems. His name, Ron Hall Jr. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're with Ron Hall Jr., the Ron Hall Jr., the president and CEO of Bridgewater Interiors, LLC. Ron, welcome. An honor to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can we start talking about your childhood and your parents, please?
Sure. I was born and raised here in the great city of Detroit. I'm a fourth generation Detroiter on my mother's side of the family, third generation on my father's side. My parents went to high school, grew up, you know, going to the public schools here. My dad went to high school at Cass Tech. My mom was across the street at what was then Commerce High School, where I-75 runs through that site today. And they met, I think they knew each other kind of in passing in high school. But they became friends and began dating when they were at college at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo at the, you know, turn of the 1960s. And lots of stories, as you might imagine, from that era as they had their student careers on that campus. And my dad was very active in the Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity, helped found that chapter that's at Western Michigan. And things, you know, they went on from there, got married after school, and I was born at the end of the decade.
Hmm. There's a couple other guests we've had, a fellow named Dennis Archer from Western Michigan, Roy Roberts, Bill Picard. That was quite a place.
Yeah, all contemporaries in Kalamazoo at Western. It's my understanding that Mr. Roberts was there after them. I think that my dad and Dr. Picard had already graduated, and Mayor Archer, I think, was slightly behind them. But they were all overlapping, and the first three of them, you know, were there together. In fact, Dr. Picard made a major donation to the university and was joined by our family and Mayor Archer's family, and erected two dormitories that are named after the three of them that stand there today. So very proud of that.
What's the biggest thing you learned from Dad, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Mom?
I think the biggest thing I learned from my dad was to worry about the things you can control. Focus on the things you can control and manage those to the extent you can. And without a doubt, the great lesson from my mother is that everything is relative. You know, whether an issue is large or small and where it fits into kind of the spectrum of your value system or judgment about whether it's good or bad, a lot, not a lot, is all relative to everything else.
In 1987, you become a cadet at the U.S. Military Academy, West Point. How and why?
You know, for me, I was one of those kids who knew very early exactly what he wanted to do and was very driven about it. I had been active in the junior ROTC program in high school. I went to Cass Tech for high school. And I well recall a conversation with my mother after school, spring of my freshman year, after I had sat in on a session with an admissions officer from the military academy who had come to talk to the cadets who were juniors and seniors at Cass in the program at Junior ROTC. And I had happened to have study hall that hour and had sought permission to not be at study hall, but to sit in on this recruiting session. And for me, that was it. Like, that was the thunderbolt. You know, the video, the books, the story of that captain standing there talking about, you know, his West Point story. And I decided, you know, I really want to go do that. And it was immediately clear to me that if I could put myself on a course to enroll to Service Academy, even if I didn't make it, I would be doing good things that would line me up for other great opportunities. And so, to me, you kind of couldn't go wrong. You know, I'd kind of shoot for it and get it, or miss and end up somewhere else that was going to set me up with opportunity for the future. So I get in the car that day. My mother used to, she taught at, you know, Miller Middle School at that time. It was Miller Middle School. And I got in the car after school that day and said, "Mama, I know what I'm going to do for college." And she kind of listened to me and kind of humored me, but I don't think she thought that it was really going to happen, you know. But I never turned away from that, not for 3 years, and then it actually happened.
There is no typical day at West Point, but talk to us, tell us, describe for us, paint us a picture of a typical day at West Point.
Well, at the academy, you're up early. You know, you get 6 a.m. formation, breakfast, and then academic classes, at least during the academic year. You know, classes from, I don't know, 7:30 or so, 7:30, 8 o'clock until lunchtime at 11 or 12. And then, you know, afternoon classes until 3 or 4. And then either, you know, if you're a core squad athlete, an intercollegiate athlete, you know, they have training and practice for their sports if they're in season, or training if they're not in season. For people like me, if you weren't an intercollegiate athlete, you still had to participate in intramural athletics, which are actually very competitive at West Point. And you parade for the public. You know, 2 of the 4 regiments would parade every day. And so you had either intramural athletics or parade, and then dinner formation, dinner, study barracks, taps at 11:30.
Brent Musburger, Mike Tirico, Bob Costas, Kirk Herbstreit all say if they could go to one football game in their life, Ron, they would go to the game in early December, the Army-Navy game. Why?
I think especially for enthusiasts of college athletics, it doesn't really get purer than that. You have athletes on both sides of the field who are true student athletes, completing, you know, the same academic curriculum as everybody else at the institution, on their way to the same kinds of professional endeavors as everybody else at the institution. And like all the cadets and midshipmen, about something larger than themselves. It's, you know, about the spirit of service, the esprit de corps, I think, that comes naturally to some extent for people who are in the armed forces. That, along with, you know, the uniforms, the pageantry, the parades, all of the long history and tradition, you know, it's a pretty exciting mix.
Both sides say at the end of that game, you want to sing second. What does that mean?
Well, the winning team gets to have its alma mater played after the losing team after the game. And so after the game is over, the players from the losing team go to their student sideline, whether it's, you know, the midshipmen or the cadets. The players from the winning team join them and stand respectfully for the playing of that school's alma mater. Then the players of the losing team join the players of the winning team on the winning team sideline for the playing of the winner's alma mater. And so certainly the goal every year is to be singing your alma mater second.
We're talking to Ron Hall Jr., When we come back, we're going to ask him about his tour of duty. If you want to learn more, www.bridgewater-interiors.com. And I'm Jack Crystal, and this is Anything is Possible on 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything is Possible. I'm Jack Crisola with Ron Hall, Jr. Ron, tell us about your tour of duty in the Army.
Well, I commissioned into the Field Artillery Branch of the Army, and I was posted at what was then Fort Hood, Texas. And that was, you know, so I graduated in 91. I had some training to complete before I got to my duty post. So it was the next spring, probably about 10 months before I actually got to Fort Hood. I went to airborne school. I had to go to the Field Artillery Officer's basic course. And that's common, you know, for academy graduates. Most have at least one and sometimes multiple schools before they get to their permanent duty station. I was assigned to the 1st Cavalry Division, 1st Battalion, 82nd Field Artillery. And that's a 155, well, at the time, it was a 155 self-propelled howitzer unit. I assume it still is. And I had a great experience. I was not high enough in the class at West Point to select my first choice of branch. The cadets choose from, you know, the available slots at each branch based on class rank. In fact, the cadets choose just about everything based on class rank. It's the most brutally fair place I've been in my life. I can still say that. And I wanted to be an armor officer, but this was the early 90s, Persian Gulf War. Armor was an exceptionally popular branch for a few years. And as a result, I was not going to be able to get armor and get the post assignment, which was the second choice I had to make, that I wanted. And so, like many cadets who were kind of middle of the class, you know, you have to be strategic about your preferences when you're seeking your branch and post. So Field Artillery was my second choice to armor, and Fort Hood was my second choice to Fort Stewart, but I felt, which is in Georgia, but I felt fortunate to get my second choices for each, and I had a great experience at Fort Hood.
All right. What did West Point and your active duty teach you about running a multi-billion dollar business?
I learned servant leadership before the term, I knew the term, before it was a popular coin of phrase in the corporate sector, I think. Everything that they teach you at West Point from the time, you know, you walk through the gates is that it's not about you, it's about the mission. It's not about you, it's about your soldiers. You seek responsibility and take responsibility for your actions is one of the first maxims you're taught. And I didn't appreciate at the time how unusual the leadership training is. There's a focus on leadership training in every element of the schooling, academic, military training, athletics participation, extracurricular participation. All of it has elements of, you know, compelling the cadets to learn and practice good leadership and good management. And so, you know, frankly, you know, by the time I came into my civilian career, I felt and learned pretty quickly that I was in some ways more prepared to manage and lead than many people in my peer group, age peer group, just because I'd had that training. And that was part of why I decided to leave the legal profession and kind of move closer to operations management.
We're talking Ron Hall, Jr. Ron Hall Jr. and servant leadership are synonymous. Anybody that knows the man says, amen.
That's very
all
kind
right.
of you. Thank
Speaking
you.
Of the law profession, from 98 to 2002, you were an associate attorney at Dykema. Quickly talk about that chapter of your life.
Great experience, great firm. The firm was very good to me, and everything that I had hoped. I had the experience I hoped to have. I was in the corporate finance practice group. I benefited from some very strong mentoring from some of the prominent partners in and around that practice group. At the time, I got exposure to people in other practice groups that has actually been a significant part of getting me involved in certain civic and charitable activities in the years since. And, Dykema is a Fortune 250 firm, so it was a chance to kind of practice big firm law in my hometown and get some of the, experience that I knew would propel me forward. One of the things I liked about practicing in Detroit's market is that it's a small enough market that you can't afford to over-specialize. You would talk mm-hmm. to friends who were at the big firms on Wall Street or in Silicon Valley or even Chicago to some extent. And it was easy to get pigeonholed and be doing the same kind of work over and over and over and over again. Here, that didn't happen because we all had to have a little bit of an entrepreneurial spirit. You had to be willing to learn different parts of the law in whatever your area of practice was and to get good at those things because you had to stay busy. Of course, the revenue generating unit in law firm life is the billable hour. And so the key for any young associate is to stay busy and keep learning.
From 2002 to 2006, you were a corporate attorney and then in a leadership development program for Johnson Controls, that up-and-coming company. Talk about that chapter.
Well, that was the window, when my career and my dad's began to merge a little bit. Bridgewater Interiors was a Johnson Controls joint venture at that time and was in its infancy. The company was... became operational in 1999. And so by the time my father got to about the 5-year mark, it was clear that the company was going to have legs, that the joint venture was going to enjoy some success. It was growing. He was going to have a need to grow the management team, professionalize it some. And I was at a juncture where it was time to kind of fish or cut bait, I felt like, and either, commit long term to developing as an attorney and having all the career opportunity I could manage in that space, or if I wanted to leverage, and this is back to that leadership and management training that we were talking about, leverage some of what I had learned in the service and have a little bit more of a hybrid career in law and business management, that it was a good time to switch. And so that's what we did. I was working as an in-house lawyer at JCI, went into their LDP program and was assigned to a plant out in Mount Clemens and, hung the suits up and put some work gloves in my back pocket and, went out to supervise a manufacturing line and moved through positions in production supervision and quality control and program management, materials management over the next several years, really in preparation for joining the management team at Bridgewater.
We're talking to Ron Hall Jr. When we come back, we're going to ask him about the joint venture in 1998. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Crisula, with Ron Hall, Jr. Your dad and Johnson Controls in 1998 had a joint venture. At the time, it was the largest minority contract ever issued by General Motors. Please.
It was an amazing time. I was, as we discussed, in junior lawyer at the time, kind of watching him from across the table as this joint venture arrangement with Johnson Controls came together. And he didn't want to do it. He was very happy as president at MMSDC. I think
Michigan
was,
Minority.
I'm sorry, the Michigan Minority Supplier Development Council. He was president there from 1992 to 98. and was, you know, widely credited with growing the organization significantly during that time and to materially contributing to strengthening supplier diversity development efforts in the automotive industry, especially, but, you know, throughout the Michigan economy. And he thought that he would be there long term. But JCI was negotiating, and he was helping to broker that discussion with another business person to start up the joint venture. And those negotiations broke down, but JCI still wanted the deal to happen, and General Motors did as well. Harold Kudner was, who never gets enough credit for, in my opinion, for his supplier diversity championing, was chairman at MMSDC at the time and was encouraging the parties to stay at the table. And they needed another business person or a group of business persons to come forward and try to create this manufacturing joint venture, which hadn't been done before. And he was asked to do it. My dad was asked to do it and was, you know, and reluctantly agreed, you know, in short. And so they formed the company in 1998. Broke ground in Detroit, built the plant that is still today operational in our headquarters facility, and became operational in 1999, building what was then the Cadillac DeVille seats. If you remember, GM was relaunching the Cadillac brand, and this was the flagship sedan. It had some of the most sophisticated seating systems in the industry. And you know, people take for granted that these kinds of companies can happen now. But at the time, there was a lot of skepticism. There hadn't been a new manufacturing facility built in Detroit in decades at that point. And so the idea that a tier one supplier was going to build a plant in the city and hire an inexperienced workforce to build some of the most sophisticated systems for the vehicle generated a fair amount of skepticism. And that was the part that my father was not worried about. He was the most optimistic person I've ever known in my life, believed very much in the community from which, he had grown up in, and knew that he could hire a workforce that could get it done with the support of, you know, business partners who were already expert in the space. And he had that in Johns Controls. John Barth was head of the automotive systems group at JCI at the time and was committed to supplier diversity as well, another great champion. And off they went together.
All right. You joined Dad in 2007 at Bridgewater. And then in 2015, he said, son, it's yours. You become president CEO.
I wish it had been that smooth. The plan was for him to step back into an executive chairman role for a few years. And we were going to glide path a little bit into the transition. But unfortunately, a significant health issue that he had a problem with, ironically, the year I joined the company, which was really just coincidental, returned. And he had to retire fairly immediately, which accelerated, you know, some of our plans. And so it was a little bit more of a trial by fire than I expected, than I think anybody at the company expected. But I can't say enough about the tremendous support I received from the entire management team, from the joint venture partners, from all the employees in the production facilities. And it really wasn't about me. I think it was out of regard for my dad that everybody supported the ideals of the company and helped the new boss kind of get his legs under him and get through those first few years.
All right. A little more than 25 years later, 2,200 employees, 1.6 billion, four plants. What does Bridgewater Interiors do today?
Today, we manufacture 100% seating systems. We have done other interior systems in the past, overhead systems, center consoles, certainly have explored and will be open to those kinds of opportunities in the future. But today, we manufacture seating systems for about a dozen different car models for four of the major OEMs. And we have some growth, we think, on the immediate horizon in that space that we're excited about. And I see us as a jobs company, first and foremost. You know, the whole reason that we are supported by our customers and other stakeholders and the supplier diversity development efforts are supported is because it's about bringing economic opportunity to areas and communities that traditionally have not had those opportunities to the same extent as the majority population. And so, to me, we are succeeding when we are employing as many people as we can, you know, at stable, you know, solidly middle-class wages with great benefits and opportunities for upward mobility. And the more of that we can do, then, to me, the more we are succeeding.
We're talking to Ron Hall, Jr. If you want to learn more, www.bridgewater-interiors.com. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on 760 WJR.
You've been listening to your inspirational fireside chat, Anything is Possible, for nearly 20 years.
This is Anything is Possible, and I'm Jack Rasula.
But what has Jack been up to lately? Search at AIP Speaker Series and find out. Jack has interviewed thousands of historical voices, some of whom have offered him their philosophy of life, like Tom Izzo.
And Tom writes, "Work hard, persistence always wins out, discipline is the highest form of love. Stay humble."
The great Ernie Harwell.
"My aim is to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with God."
And the voices of our generation.
"I am reassured continuously that His unfathomable love and mercy are the greatest gifts of my life and my constant source of strength, reassurance, and guidance. His Holiness, Pope Francis."
At AIP Speakers Series is the YouTube channel where all of these jewels can be heard, including some of Anything is Possible's greatest guests.
And we're with Mitch Albom.
The Little Liar is really a book about truth and lies and the price we pay when we lie.
This is Anything is Possible, and with Tom Watson.
My father loved to play with the pros at the club, developed a very quick friendship with Stan and played some golf with him. And then he would ask me to play golf with him and Stan.
Our guest this week was born with a rare disorder characterized by the absence of arms and legs. His name, Nick Vujicic.
Something that every human being actually deals with, Jack. It's the choice of continuing to believe or giving up.
And recordings of the AIP Speaker Series events at St. John's Resort. Go to YouTube and search at AIP Speaker Series. It's free. And remember,
anything.
I'm Jack Rasula. We're with Ron Hall, Jr., President and CEO, Bridgewater Interiors, LLC. Right between the two bridges. Wow. All right. Ron, talk about the evolution of interior seating in an automobile.
Well, my understanding is that in the 1980s, really as a labor arbitrage move, that the automakers began to eliminate what were called cushion rooms, where they had semi-separate operations to manufacture their seating systems, and those would ship in on-site, you know, to an assembly plant. They segregated those operations. They sold them to suppliers who would take responsibility for designing, engineering, manufacturing these systems, and then eventually, you know, building them in a mass production environment and shipping them into the automaker's assembly plant. And so, you know, there are a handful of global publicly traded firms that do this, and then, you know, another handful that are partially owned by major automakers. That's more the model, for example, with the Asia automakers. And But the setup, I think, is similar probably in certainly internationally in the Adient operation. And Adient, I should say, is a successor to JCI. We've talked a lot about JCI, but you know, Adient is the firm that was spun off from JCI. The Automotive Systems Group at JCI was spun off into a separate company at the tail end of 2016. And so Bridgewater is now an Adient joint venture as opposed to a JCI joint venture. But seat suppliers set up, you know, within 30 miles or so of an assembly plant, receive a broadcast from the assembly plant, and assemble seating systems in sequence to order. So if you can imagine, you know, if you, I don't know, Jack, if you drive a Ford F-150, but, you know.
Cadillac.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the Ford F-150. Okay. So down at the Rouge plant, because we supply those seating systems, the Rouge plant sends us a broadcast. Okay, we're going to build, you know, blue, gray, black, leather, cloth, power, ventilated, you know, whatever. And we get a broadcast with exactly what they want for a vehicle. And our workers, in this case in Warren, Michigan, build the seat, almost custom build the seat per that broadcast ticket. And they have to do it, you know, in order. So whatever order the assembly plant is building the trucks, we have to build the seating systems in the same order, get them down our assembly line, trucked over to Dearborn, and ready for installation at the assembly plant. It's typically 3.5-4 hours when things are operating smoothly. And so it's a very highly choreographed operation. And that's really the secret sauce of what we do.
How many components in a seat today in an automobile?
Well, 150 to 200, depending on the seating system, the level of luxury, the level of content, we call it. You know, how many bells and whistles you have. You know, if you buy a work truck and it's just a seat, you know, with a cloth cover and manual adjustment controls, then there will be relatively fewer pieces. But if you're buying, you know, a Ram 1500, you know, we assemble those seats in Warren as well. That's, you know, we have these, the tungsten edition seats now that, I mean, are just amazingly complex with, you know, lots of, you know, lumbar support and massagers, and it's heated and ventilated, and there's speakers in the seats, and just amazingly complex. And so it just kind of depends, but it can be a couple of hundred pieces.
All right. Dad taught you a lot of things, and Mom. One was, son, give back to the community, which you do fabulously well, Mr. Hall.
Thank you.
You've been a huge supporter of something called PAL, Police Athletic League, our own Paul W. Smith, iconic. Talk about PAL. And you were a board chair for a number of years.
I was. So I got involved in a predecessor organization to what is now Detroit PAL called Think Detroit in the early 2000s. Good friends of mine from law school, Dan Varner and Mike Tinbush, were the founders at Think Detroit, and doing some important work over on the east side at Meharis Gentry Park, trying to create opportunities for baseball little leaguers. And if you recall, you know, the early 2000s was a very tough time for the city's departments, and in this case, the Parks and Recreation Department, which could not afford to upkeep all the facilities as much as it would have wanted. And I helped them broker a deal with the Parks and Recs Department so that we would renovate the ball fields in exchange for being able to prioritize league play for our kids. On those fields. And so that was my first involvement, and I went on to the board with them after that. We merged with Detroit PAL in 2006, and then I was on the board at the combined organization for another decade. And the window when I was chairman, as you referenced, was when we redeveloped the old Tiger Stadium site.
What was that like?
That was an amazing experience. I didn't have any experience in real estate development. I didn't have any experience in significant fundraising. We had something like a $350,000 or $400,000 budget, and we had to raise, well, we thought we had to raise about $16 million. It ended up being 20. And but the impetus was Senator Levin, the great Carl Levin, who had earmarked HUD development dollars for the redevelopment of the old Tiger Stadium site, but had put control of the site in the hands of the old Tiger Stadium Conservancy, and insisted that a redevelopment that honored the history of the site be, you know, be a part of it if the HUD dollars were going to be gained. And so that really put us, you know, squarely in play to redevelop the site amidst a lot of competing ideas for what else might go there. And so they needed a nonprofit that everybody liked and trusted to kind of step forward and lead the redevelopment of the site. And Detroit PAL at that time was in need of another headquarters. We were in a small building near the Wayne State campus.
All right. Another entity, the Rondo Walker Foundation.
I was just with Rondo Walker on last week on Thursday, as a matter of fact. She spoke at a Black History event at Adient, and we were very pleased to help host her there and to present another donation check to her great foundation, which I'm pleased to say took us over the $100,000 mark in support of the Rhonda Walker Foundation. And just cannot say enough about the way Rhonda has leveraged her local celebrity status to support girls throughout the Detroit region. It's just fantastic.
All right, as our time winds down, what advice do you give to our young listeners today?
Dream big, believe in yourself, work hard, and don't assume as a young person that you know exactly where you're going to end up, but keep creating opportunities for yourself. Make one good decision at a time and enjoy the blessings that come of that when you're doing great things later.
And I would add one more prescription. Live your life like Ron Hall Jr.
That's very kind of you. Thank you.
Please join us next week. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spalding.